Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The call to ban assault rifles is running up against the fact that defining exactly what is an assault rifle is easier said than done.
They made the attempt. Bless their heart, they tried, but they went too far.
Also this week, educational equity is a core concept in Florida, but does the concept and reality jibe?
Most middle-class families, their kids are able to play sports, they're able to do after-school, arts programs, they have summer camps, etc. Low-income kids don't have any of those developmental opportunities.
We'll also talk about the shaky status of Florida's official tourism marketing corporation and explore the frustrations of another industry-connected organization that just can't seem to get an appointment booked with Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. If you caught Thursday night's Democratic presidential debate in Houston, you likely saw that state's Beto O'Rourke call for a total ban on firearms like the AR-15 and AK-47, popularly called assault rifles. But it would appear the seemingly simple exercise of defining what is and is not an assault weapon is fiendishly complex. A proposed Florida assault weapons ban would prohibit all semi-automatic shotguns and rifles that are capable of holding more than 10 rounds. State economists say that would affect around 71% of rifles and half of shotguns. Charlie Strickland, CEO of Tallahassee-based Talon Training Groups, says it would leave a gaping exit wound in his business. Capitol reporter Blaise Ganey spoke with Strickland to find out exactly how.
By the definition of this, almost every semi-automatic sporting shotgun in the state of Florida would be banned. No more sale, no more manufacture. How does it affect my business as a gun manufacturer? Well, that would be gone because we only build AR-15 style rifles. It's not a large part of my business, but it is certainly a draw. It gets people in the door.
Inside his store, Strickland points out which of his inventory would and wouldn't be affected.
Our gun sales here in the store are predominantly handguns, but we do sell an awful lot of AR-15 style rifles, antique rifles that fit the same criteria. We have a lot of consignment sales come in that are older guns that fit the same definition of this amendment proposal, and semi-automatic shotguns.
Strickland says the guns the amendment would ban are about a third of his sales, possibly forcing him to close. Even his shooting range would be affected. That's because the guns prohibited by the ban are among the most popular.
Probably 80% of the shotguns we see on our skeet, trapping, sporting clays facility are semi-automatic shotguns that under this would be banned.
While people could simply use other shotguns that would be allowed, he said he highly doubts that happened.
That's not what's fun for most people, and it's not what they're used to shooting. So can it be done? Absolutely it can be done. Is it what's going to happen? No, people will just stop.
But he insisted shotguns shouldn't even be prohibited, since they are rarely, if ever, used in mass shootings.
Now, when they added shotguns, they really went a bridge too far. I think if they had left it with rifles, we'd have a harder time arguing against it.
Strickland says the difficulty in trying to ban guns the way the amendment does is that it's too hard to try and stop manufacturers from getting around the rules.
In California, they just put a little button on the side of the gun, made it harder to reload. You know, there's always a way to change things, and there's always a way around it.
When questioned if banning specific gun models would be better, he says no.
Now you can make a list of manufacturers and say these manufacturers with these model numbers, they'll just start new companies and add new models faster, the same way they do with designer drugs. I mean, they just change the chemical formulation and then all of a sudden it's not banned until they can figure it out.
Strickland says in the short term, businesses like his would be out of business, but in the long run, gun manufacturers will just create weapons that have the same effects but aren't designed like the banned versions.
They cannot define this without going overly far, and that's what they've done here is they made the attempt. Bless their heart, they tried, but they went too far.
As of today, the petition for the ban has 105,000 signatures. To make it on the ballot, it must get over 766,000 by February. I'm Blaze Ganey.
In recent weeks, a common theme has emerged from two of Florida's top education leaders, addressing equity in education. Lynn Hatter sat down with Fed Ingram, president of the state's largest teachers union, the Florida Education Association. She also spoke with Doug Tuthill, president of the biggest corporate tax scholarship program, Step Up for Students, to discuss the issue. For people usually on different sides of education policy, both are deeply invested in promoting equity in public education. But what does equity look like? Here's part of those conversations.
We don't want equality. We want equity. We want to make sure that everybody will start at the same starting line so that they have an opportunity to finish when they're supposed to finish that race.
Florida Education Association President Fed Ingram is making a distinction between equity and equality. A lot of people use that term thinking that they're synonyms.
Sure.
Explain this.
So if I have a kid who was born on the south side of town, and maybe their family has generational poverty, maybe their mom or dad didn't complete high school, maybe they have had some setbacks and obstacles as a family core. And then I have a student who was born into wealth, a student who was born knowing that their family understood the value of education and higher education, and that it was understood that you were going to go and get a master's degree, not a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. I want to make sure that both these kids have what they need.
Most middle-class families, their kids are able to play sports, they're able to do after-school, arts programs, they have summer camps, et cetera. Low-income kids don't have any of those developmental opportunities.
That question of equity versus equality is one Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill has given a lot of thought to as a school choice proponent.
It's not rational to think that schools are capable of dealing with generational poverty by themselves. It's not possible. You can't expect teachers working with kids 6 hours a day, 180 days a year, to deal with all the inequities that are in society that kids are having to deal with.
Both Ingram and Tuthill want to bring parity to education. They say the state has not gotten serious about addressing equity in its schools. Ingram believes state lawmakers are partly to blame for that.
Right now, they're telling you, hey, the school in your community, in this zip code, is not good enough. Go out to this school. And so what that is an undergird that your community is not good enough, that families in this area are not good enough. This is the problem that we have with the grading system as well. When you grade a school enough, you not only grade that school enough, you grade that community, every family, every business. Because what business person or what healthcare person wants to put their business in the center of an F community.
And speaking last year at the Chicago Ideas Festival, Tuthill echoed that sentiment. He discussed why he sent his son to the only F school in St. Petersburg.
For my particular child, it was an A school. And there are schools out there that when I taught it, which was an A school, everybody fought to get in. But for a lot of kids, that was a failing school. So we got to get out of this notion of one size fits all or these grade, blah, blah. Those things are all, I think, off topic. The real question is, how do we put great educators in every school? How do we support those educators? And how do we match the child with the learning environment that best meets their needs?
Ingram's solution? Raise teacher pay. Invest in traditional public schools.
It is still the cornerstone of that democracy. That public school in a Black community or Hispanic community used to be everything. It used to be the center of everything that we thought was hope and opportunity. It's very different now because now we've listened to so much of this propaganda that tells you, well, the school down the street or the school 5 miles from here is a much better opportunity for your kid. Well, why not fix the school in the community? Are we saying that zip code does not deserve a proper school? And then what do we do with the kids who can't go to X charter school? What do we do with the kids who can't pay for X private school? What do we do with those kids? Every kid, your kid and my kid, every grandkid, every niece, every nephew deserves an opportunity. And we ought to give that to them. And the only way that we can scale up is by our public schools.
And as a former teachers union official, Tuthill even floats the idea of union membership for charter and private school educators. He wants to give families greater ownership of their schools by giving them money.
Our hope is eventually to turn all of our scholarship programs into these educational scholarship accounts. The way that works is that money goes into an account for the family. It's well regulated to make sure that the money is spent appropriately, but they have the flexibility just not to spend money on school opportunities, but on after-school programs that more affluent families have access to.
And that money, that power, that's been at the center of Florida's fight over public education for the past 20 years. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, since his inauguration back in January, Governor DeSantis has seemed a pretty accessible kind of guy. But the folks in the Florida Defense Alliance just can't seem to get an appointment set up with him.
I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. There's something else at work here. I don't know what it is, but it's not doing Florida any good.
And is it even possible that one of Florida's most iconic arboreal symbols could be in danger of disappearing?
We'll have to spend a lot of money to keep this problem, hopefully, away from their palms. It's still not a guarantee.
Florida's tourism numbers are growing. They're high enough to make up for other industries, like construction, that the state's chief economist says are lagging. But as lawmakers stare down a tight budget year and a projected economic slowdown, the question becomes, how long can tourism compensate? Regan McCarthy has more.
Florida is known for its vacation spots. Beautiful beaches, warm water, and sunshine. So far this year, Visit Florida, the state's tourism development arm, has counted about 70 million visitors. Amy Baker, the state's chief economist, says that's good news.
We had very strong 5.8% growth coming out of 18-19 over 17-18. So altogether, tourism is compensating for what we're seeing in construction. So we're seeing the economy overall is largely back to normal.
While the state's tourism industry is looking bright, Baker says the state's financial forecast isn't quite as sunny. She says the national economy is becoming more volatile, and an economic slowdown could be coming in 2020. While officials aren't currently predicting a recession, Baker says she can't rule it out.
And so even though we do not anticipate a recession, the caveat is that turning points in the economy are very, very difficult to predict. Those inflection points are hard to pin down, even if you're confident it's coming. Picking what quarter or what month or even what fiscal year is really difficult. Economists nationally are split.
Meanwhile, some of the industries that are typically drivers for growth in Florida are, in Baker's words, dragging. She says that's okay because right now tourism is making up for it. The question is, how long will that last? While overall tourism numbers are up, international tourism numbers are down. And during the most recent legislative session, lawmakers seriously considered defunding Visit Florida, the organization responsible for attracting visitors to the state.
What we found in the last couple of years was a great deal of that money was not even really being used to promote Florida. So whatever amount of money was being used to promote Florida was not having a direct correlation on tourism.
House Speaker Jose Oliva led the push to end the state's role in funding Visit Florida. He argues a decrease in funding doesn't mean a decrease in tourism. But the organization's CEO, Dana Young, says cutting funding for tourist development organizations has proven detrimental in other states.
The state of Colorado did something similar many years ago. They defunded their tourism marketing agency. They lost billions of dollars. It took them 20 years to recover. But conversely, Utah, who's their neighboring state, increased their tourism marketing budget, and their market share increased dramatically.
Governor Ron DeSantis stepped in, asking lawmakers to fund the agency. In the end, Visit Florida received $50 million, enough to keep the agency going through the current fiscal year. But a new legislative session starts in January, and that could mean Visit Florida's fate hangs in the balance again. Following Baker's presentation about the state's current economic forecast, House Budget Chair, Orange Park Republican Representative Travis Cummings, said the House wants to make sure any money earmarked for Visit Florida is spent well.
Hey, tourism, as was outlined here today, is extremely important. Do spending taxpayer dollars result in more tourists coming here? We think we've got such a great quality of life and so many amenities and values that people are going to come here.
Cummings says funding Visit Florida is a year-to-year decision that will depend on what other priorities or needs come up as lawmakers hammer out a spending plan. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Some board members of the Florida Defense Alliance are irked they can't get any FaceTime with Governor Ron DeSantis. Ryan Daly reports the issue came to a head during a Thursday conference call held by the group.
The Florida Defense Alliance is a state-created consortium of defense organization representatives. It's housed under Enterprise Florida, which is chaired by the governor. But some of the alliance board members are peeved because after the better part of a year in office, they haven't met with DeSantis in person. Executive board member Jim Brightonfield made his frustrations known.
Have we had a chance to even brief the governor yet? It's been 8 months since he's been in office, and I know we never got a chance really to brief the governor, not staff, not third assistant deputy, Tuesday and Wednesday staffers, but have we had a chance to actually brief the governor on what the issues are, face-to-face, our people briefing the governor? Because if we don't do that, we're not going to get anywhere.
Ray Collins heads the Florida Defense Support Task Force, a council also housed under Enterprise Florida. He was also on the call. Collins suggested DeSantis may not have made time for the Defense Alliance yet because he's relatively new to the job.
Jim, if I can respond to what you said, we are working on that. We keep calling the governor's scheduling people, and so far we haven't broken through. And it may be a combination of the fact that, Governor DeSantis is still in, coming close, he's more than halfway through his first year, but he's still working through some issues of working how to be an executive, a chief executive for the first time. And so there's still some things happening slower than they should. That's one of them.
But Brightonfield, who said he's too old to stay quiet about the matter, told Collins he doesn't accept that excuse.
That makes absolutely no sense to me at all. So the second or third largest economic sector in the state, 700,000 jobs. The man is former military. I just don't buy it. There's something else at work here. It's, I don't know what it is. But it's not doing Florida any good.
Defense Alliance Chair Kelly Jo Kilberg said after the call, she hopes to have an all-encompassing briefing with DeSantis to discuss, quote, the opportunity to get him the complete story of how our Florida military complex is a unique, key asset in the national defense strategy. Meanwhile, Ray Collins says legislators who are members of the Defense Support Task Force are currently trying to set up a meeting with DeSantis in the coming week.
Our legislative members of the task force have been trying to get in to see him as a group of legislators and see him as a group next week when they're all here in committee. I have not heard yet whether or not they've succeeded in getting on his calendar, but they are also working on trying to do that at their level, to present that same case and explain to him what they're doing.
Collins didn't say specifically which legislative members of the task force have contacted the governor's office, but among those members are Republican Representatives Jay Trumbull, Holly Reschein, Thad Altman, and Mel Ponder. Republican Senator Doug Broxson chairs the group. DeSantis's office did not respond to WFSU's request for comment Thursday. I'm Ryan Daly.
It's hard to picture Florida without palm trees. They line the state's highways and beaches and are abundant at parks and resorts. It's difficult to imagine a Florida sunset without a palm somewhere along the horizon. Now an invasive bacteria is increasingly threatening Florida's iconic palms, including the state tree, the sable palm. WGCU's Andrea Perdomo has more.
About 100 yards from the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, Broward Extension, is a sort of palm tree graveyard.
Yeah, that one's completely dead. There's another one over there that still has some of the petiole bases at the top. And then this one is starting to show symptoms, but that one's essentially a goner.
UF's Dr. Brian Bader surveys a handful of palms in different stages of death after contracting what's called lethal bronzing disease.
You want to swing by the lab? And
yeah, that would be cool, if you don't mind.
Yeah, not at all.
The disease first popped up in Hillsborough County back in 2006 and has been spreading throughout the state ever since.
Historically, it was more prevalent in the central part of the state. Now it's starting to get a stronger foothold down here. I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Bader has been spearheading research on lethal bronzing. He says LBD kills palms from the inside. An infected bug transfers a parasitic bacteria into a healthy palm while feeding, and that bacteria multiplies in the palm's circulatory system, clogging it up and depriving the palm of the nutrients it needs to survive. Manny Nasser is an arborist with the Davy Tree Company. He has been in the tree business for 30 years and is concerned about the spread of LBD.
I've been in the industry for that long, and I've never seen anything that has come on this quick and this aggressive.
The palms most susceptible to LBD are Phoenix palms, which are commonly found in resorts, and Florida state tree, the sable palm. Nasser says that's a big problem for Florida.
Because that's a commonly planted palm along the turnpike, along I-95, along I-75, anytime they do any mitigation or renovation of areas around ramps or in the median areas, they usually plant the sable palm.
Once a palm is infected with LBD, it's a goner. Infected palms need to be removed immediately to prevent further spread. There is a preventative antibiotic that can be injected into palms, but it costs roughly $50 per injection and it only lasts about 3 months.
It's not cheap, so people that value their palms, if they've had this diagnosed in their area, we'll have to spend a lot of money to keep this problem hopefully away from their palms. It's still not a guarantee.
LBD has been confirmed in 31 counties in Florida so far. An infected palm can go months before showing symptoms, so in many cases, people are inadvertently transporting infected palms into new areas. Entomologist Jeffrey Ike Wart is a supervisor for the Florida Forest Service.
There's no statewide effort to go out and try to eradicate it from the environment, and frankly, I'm not even sure what such an effort would look like.
He says LBD is a difficult disease to try to wrangle, especially because the only way to confirm a case is through testing a tissue sample.
It's not like it moves into a stand and then every single palm dies. Instead, it's something that very gradually kills trees in a very scattershot way across the landscape, and that makes it very, very difficult to come up with any effective response.
Palms susceptible to LBD also grow in Texas, where the disease was first found in this country, as well as in Louisiana and up to the Carolinas. Back in his lab, UF's Dr. Brian Bader says if the disease continues to spread, it could also devastate the landscaping and ornamental crop industries.
You know, I've had some nursery owners tell me they're in the millions of dollars of losses in certain plots because their plots just get completely wiped out by the disease. So we haven't done a full in-depth cost analysis of the impact, but it's getting up there quick.
Bader regularly hosts informational workshops on his LBD research that are open to the public. The next one is coming up September 25th at the IFAS Davy Extension location. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrea Perdomo.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, we live in an information age, and you can have all the information in the world, but it's useless if you can't understand it. And that's the case for a lot of Guatemalan Mayans in Palm Beach County. WLRN's Madeline Fox introduces us to a group of teenagers who are trying to bridge a language gap. They call themselves the Mayan Girls.
Last year, a group of Lake Worth High School girls needed community service hours to graduate.
Hello, good afternoon. We are the Mayan Girls.
By the spring, they were on stage at the Kravis Center in West Palm Beach, speaking Kanhobal. The event was a Shark Tank-style pitch session in front of a panel of judges.
Our project is about translating important information into a Mayan language. Our budget is $15,000, and our main expenses will be going towards equipment, outreach, upcoming events, and laptops.
They work out of the Guatemalan Maya Center. they can speak to the center's clients in a way even its own staff can't always do.
I have tons of information, but I can't get it to them because I personally don't speak a Mayan language.
Daniel Morgan is a social worker at the center. He's also the Mayan Girls advisor for their community service hours. There's a room at the center lined with chairs where people can wait for help. Morgan sits at the end at a desk, walking people through paperwork.
So if I run into somebody who barely any Spanish, like I really can't use my Spanish with her, I'll ask the clients in the waiting room, or I'll call up one of my trusted translators.
So the girl started in that rotation of trusted translators, interpreting on the spot between Morgan and his clients. Lorena Felipe Sebastian translates information into the Mayan language Canjobal for a lot of the center's clients.
Sometimes when I see them, they seem frustrated that they don't understand it. But like when we're there, they feel more relieved that we're there to help them. They have a better understanding of what others are trying to tell them.
But Lorena and the other girls are in high school during the day. They can't be at the center most of the time. So Morgan suggested the girls start recording some information. They gather around a table in whatever room of the Guatemalan Maya Center is quietest with their assignment. One week, it was a flyer about domestic violence. Here's high schooler Ramona Francisco reading the flyer in Spanish.
Un promedio de más de tres mujeres y un hombre son asesinados.
Then the girls discuss the flyer, trying to find words in Canjobal for some of the trickier Spanish concepts. They're not professional translators, they're teenagers. And Google Translate doesn't work for Canjobal. So sometimes they talk their way around words. In this case, promedio, or average. Then Lorena counts Ramona in to start recording. The girls are comfortable using software to record on a computer or a phone. They're digital natives. And that's perfect for the people this is for. Guatemala has one of the lowest literacy rates in the Western Hemisphere, and it's particularly low in indigenous communities. Audio recordings and videos can reach a lot more people than a written flyer. And the girls want to make more sophisticated videos with skits in Canjobal. That's why they went to Philanthropy Tank for the $15,000 in March.
Yuval Chandio Shaya Atiempo. Thank you for your time.
They got the money and already put some of it towards a back-to-school event where they passed out school supplies. Equipment is next on the list.
The camera, the microphone, the one that hangs on the computer.
The Mayan girls are bringing technology to their project. They're also carrying on a legacy of translation. Polly Gaspar Shunkash co-founded the Guatemalan Maya Center. She died in May. She used her Mayan language skills to help indigenous women get prenatal services they desperately needed. Lorena's not sure she wants to make a career out of this.
For me, I mean, I want to work with the center, but like later on in my future, I want to be a boss in construction and roofing.
The Mayan girls do want more students to join them and more languages beyond Canjobal.
When I go to my classes, it's always that I hear a person speaking a Mayan language.
As the changing climate has pushed more indigenous Guatemalans to Lake Worth, there are more trilingual kids here who speak Mam, Quiche, or Acateco. Their families need information in those languages, too. I'm Madeline Fox in Lake Worth Beach.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Andrea Perdomo. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.